still
dangerous. What's your goalie doing, Tom? What's your goalie doing?
This is a football fans podcast and people behind Celtic Underground. .net. I'm Harry Brady, and this week we've got two very special guests for you. Excellent one-to-one interviews with Stevie Woods and John Kennedy. Stevie Woods, as you all know, spent much of his playing career at Motherwell. He is a lifelong Celtic supporter, and he is credited for bringing the best out on or in three of the best goalkeepers that I've seen at Celtic Park, and that's Arthur Borage, Fraser Foster and Craig Gordon. He gives us a bit of an insight into doing that. Certainly for me, it sounds like it's as much psychological as technical. And we also have the guest on from the coaching staff, and Mr. John Kennedy, who lays to bed the myth that he is the defensive coach. And pretty much from both John and Stevie, there's no such thing as a guy who just is the defensive coach. It's a footballing unit that plays in attack and defence. Anyway, enough of me. Got a special tribute at the end. We had the death of Ken Dodd this week and the rise of the comedy genius pairing that was Tom Miller and Hugh Burns on Rangers TV. So I've combined all of that to a fantastic tribute right at the very end that you can listen to. Also uploaded it separately. So enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, John Kennedy, and him, Stevie Woods. So I'm joined now by what I'm told by my secret mole inside Celtic Park are the real coaching brains behind the club, Stevie Woods and John Kennedy. I'm actually told, sorry Stevie, that John is the preeminent coach in Celtic.
I'll accept that.
So before we can start any podcast, I need to get your Celtic credentials. You may be coaches here, but that doesn't mean that you're... should be here. So I'll start with you, Stevie. What was your first Celtic game and who was your first Celtic hero?
First Celtic game was 1977, Celtic against Liverpool. It was Jock Stein's testimonial. I got dragged along by my dad, never knew what to expect. I think it was 3-1 to Liverpool. And my first hero, I took a couple of years away from it and then came to see Celtic really regularly after that. Went to a lot of European games. My first hero would have been Paddy Bonner.
Right.
So I had outfield heroes of Paul McStay and Davy Proven, but Paddy Bonner was my real hero.
Right, and did you aspire to be a goalkeeper like Paddy Bonner?
No. but he was the reason that I went in goals. He was, if Paddy's performing week in, week out, 600 and odd games for Celtic, that's something to aspire to. So he had fantastic qualities I liked then, you know, and confidence, and I loved watching him play.
See, Peter Latchford was my Celtic hero.
I just missed Peter. So Peter came in a few times. I wasn't exposed to him at all, so I can't really comment.
You can tell by my physique, that's why Peter Latchford.
Is Peter Latchford. No, Peter comes up here and works with our academy as well, so I see him a lot. But and he coached me laterally at Motherwell for a little while. And I know him really, really well, but I wasn't exposed to watch him play.
John, your first Celtic game, first Celtic hero?
The easiest thing for me would be actually make a game up, but I don't actually remember the first game. It was actually a general early 90s. So I basically grew up in a very much a Celtic family.
Yeah.
My grandfather played with Celtic way back. So pretty much my whole mum's side was Celtic. That I grew up in the village of Clern, you know, very much Celtic based. So was constantly surrounded by it. And I just remember bits and pieces of games being young. Probably late 80s, early 90s, going along with Uncle John at the time, taking me to games. I remember if I was in Hampden, being at Celtic Park, I remember the whole thing. But growing up through that era, it was very much Paul McStay. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was younger, I was, believe it or not, a midfielder for a period. So Paul McStay was the one who, you know, was the captain of Celtic, was Mr. Celtic, the maestro, and, you know, everybody wanted to be him. And then as time progressed, before I kind of came full time, early teenage years, you had your De Canios and Cadettis and Van Hooydonks and all these guys. So, you know, I was spoiled at that time because it was quality players, although, you know, on pitch we weren't winning so much, but the actual quality player at that time was very good. But I actually couldn't tell you because it was that early, the exact first game I was at.
So how did you convert from a midfielder into a defender? Because that's one of the things I often notice about players. I mean, was it Kieran Tierney was... when he's rated as this great player by World Soccer Magazine, whatever it was, he was a winger.
Yeah, it was.
And then people hit the first team, and everybody thinks he's always been that position. So how did you emerge from being a midfielder?
I think the coaches just made a decision, right? I mean, midfield, sticking back one. But to be fair, I was comfortable doing both. Even as a young player, I used to go between. And I think when you were young, you were pretty much just play anywhere. You know, mm-hmm. you go out to the school team, you were playing midfield, you were up front, you were at the back. So I was comfortable, but I remember when I got to about probably 13, you know, around about there, that decision was kind of made, where I played mostly as a central defender and kind of learned that position. But, you know, that's,
were you always tall when you were younger?
Yeah, you know, so in terms of, I had good legs and energy when I was young, midfield, but, you know, probably the right decision was made looking back on it.
And Stevie, you said you always see your heroes, Paddy Bonner. Were you always going to be a goalkeeper?
Started off as left back with the school team and very quickly get shoved in goals. But no, that was always going to be my calling. Very quickly played for the school team, played for Oaklepatrick Juveniles, and then get scouted by Hibs and mm-hmm. other clubs and made the choice to go to Hibs. So it was an easy decision to make.
So both of you, tell me about, Stevie, you go first. Tell me about your first team game of football. How did it come about? Did you know it was coming, that type of thing?
First team game of football I had was at Hibs. My one and only appearance for Hibs before I left to go to Clyde Bank was against Chelsea pre-season. And it was one of those games where you get a half, another goalie gets a half. Mm-hmm. And they had David Speedy, and they had Tom Boyd, and they had Dave Besant. They had all these top England stars as well, Kerry Dixon. So it was a great experience for me, flung in at the deep end. I think we ended up drawing the game. But no, it was then I realised that I wanted to play every single week, and that's what made my decision to leave Hibs and go and play for Clyde Bank. So that was my first professional game.
So did you have much preparation that you were definitely going to be getting a half?
Oh, I had a pretty good idea all pre-season that I was going to get a game. So, you know, the whole of pre-season was looking forward to this game, and it just whets your appetite. You know, the whole week makes sense. If you train all week and then there's a game at the end of it, it does make sense. Mm-hmm. The whole system works. But if you're not playing, then you're frustrated, and you end up, you know, totally frustrated with football, totally frustrated with life, but it all makes sense if you've got a game at the end of it. So that's my decision. I decided to go down the division, come out of the Premier League, go to the first division with Clyde Bank, and then played for 2.5 years.
And did Clyde Bank say to you, you're coming here to be first choice goalkeeper?
I had a pretty good idea that was right. the plan, and I knew that, you know, in front of me at Hibs there was John Burridge, there previously had been Andy Gorham, and they were respected goalies at the time, quite happy to sit behind them. But when I went to Clyde Bank, I realised that Jim Gallagher wasn't going to play for too much longer, mm-hmm. and that I was going to get a plan. There was a plan in place for me to play there.
And John, you're one of these people that, as a fan, your name's getting talked about. This is it's a wee bit different nowadays to our age. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, in terms of a player would suddenly just hit the first team, whereas once you got into the much more media age, there was lots of talk of there's these players coming through the youth system, so you'd be more talked about. But talk about your first team game.
First appearance, actually, was a real shock to me because it was actually my first year in full time. So I was 16, the norm, you come in, your first pre-season, you're kind of finding your feet and you're pretty much on the duties. Mm-hmm. So for the first half of the season, you're working with the youth team, you're playing on your Saturday, you're doing the match day kit, you're lifting hampers, you're cleaning boots, you're doing all that side of it. And that was, you know, part of the course and how you worked back in the day. And there was a change after the kind of winter time. I remember going into the January, playing in a friendly with reserve team against Livingston, who had a kind of fringe first team out and did really well. And from that moment on, I played pretty much in every single reserve match and playing as well on a Saturday with the youths. So, you know, it seemed to be all of a sudden you've propelled into the reserves very quickly and playing there under Kenny McDowell and Danny McGrain, obviously. And then it was in going into March and then we played, it was a Monday night, we played Rangers at the old St Mirren's ground, which was called
Love Street,
and we played Rangers on the Monday night, and they had a strong team out, you know, they had several first team players getting game time and everything else, and we beat them, played well on the night, but again coming in to training the next morning, and I remember going to Barrowfield, going in, because we at the time the reserve changed at Barrowfield. And obviously the first team changed at Celtic Park and both were trained, but so came in usual day after the game, we're not going to do too much today. Came in for my breakfast, and I remember having a bowl of cereal in my hand, ready to pour the milk in, and Kenny McDowell saying to me, you're going to train with the first team today. And I just remember saying, yeah, all right, and kept pouring my milk.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, and he says, no, you're training with the first team. And again, I says to him, okay. And he actually had to come and say to me, no, you're actually training with the first team. Because I was a young boy, had gone from kind of doing the boots, being a harper, to say, no, you're training with them today. So I was thinking, wow. So okay. So I went out, trained, did my bit. I remember getting pulled at the end of the training by Kenny Dalglish. Says, listen, you're going to be in the squad tomorrow night, you know, so you can let your mum and dad and that know you're going to be in the 18. Da da da. So I'm like, what's going on here? I remember getting back to the dressing room, getting home and saying to mum, I'm in the first team squad tomorrow night. And she's like, what? She's like, you're in the first team squad? I'm like, yeah, I'm in the first team squad. So the next thing, mum, as usual, phoning uncles, phoning aunties every day. So anyway, just thinking, right, great experience for me, getting a wee opportunity to travel with the first team, be around it. And then we go, get in the dressing room, he names the team, he names the bench, I'm on the bench, I'm thinking, what's going on here? Just played in the reserve game 2 nights ago. And so fine, go out for the warm-up, and it's one of those, first experience really on the pitch,
mm-hmm.
you know. So being there and thinking, this is amazing, this is unbelievable. And I remember we were 4-0 up, I'm sure it was, and I'm out, going to get a warm-up, so there's three as usual, banging the goal, warming up. I remember kind of hearing a shout or a whistle, and looking down, there's three is lined up, and Kenny's kind of pointing, and like giving it the old come in one. So I'm like, on my, looking to my left and seeing, like, who's that there? Right? I'm looking, and they're not moving, and I'm thinking, it's not me. And I'm going, like, me? And then he's going, yeah, you, get in. So I'm like jogging back in. I just remember the jog back in along, you know, the family stand, jogging towards the dugout, thinking, am I just about to go on the pitch here? You know, and it wasn't nerves at that point. I've just kind of went into a fit of almost excitement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, this is really happening. You know, in the last 24 hours, it's just gone from, you know, being a youth and a reserve player to you're about to make a debut for the first team. And again, going back to my childhood, growing up, watching it from the stands, having that kind of Celtic feeling, the passion and everything else, it's like, okay, I'm now on the other side, I'm now going to pitch, and I'm surrounded by all these people who I used to sit amongst. So I just remember being on the side of the pitch and waiting the ball going out to play, desperate to get me on. And then that happened, went on the pitch, I think it was the last 15 minutes, and then you come back and you sit in the dressing room, and it was just like, just the ultimate buzz, you know. And I think that's something that I'll never forget, and I think it's something that always stuck with me through my times as I progressed, you know, into the first team more regularly. When I was out injured, it was always that initial feeling that, you know, gave me the motivation, because I wanted to feel it again, you know. And I think every time you went and played for Celtic, you had a feeling. And for me, it was never like a real nerves, it was the excitement and like wanting to go out there and do it. But the first initial feeling of that was, you know, just burst on the scene, and it was, you know, it's an incredible feeling. It's something I'll just always savour and keep with me.
It's different for goalkeepers, because you can only get involved in the play when the play comes to you, really.
Exactly.
Is there a temptation to run around like a headless chicken when you come on as a sub?
No, I think, I remember speaking to some of the players and the manager, and they said, like,
I'm not saying you did, I'm just saying this.
No. And I remember going on, and Kenny basically just said to me, like, you've been doing great, just go and do what you've been doing. Just go out and play, enjoy it. I think 4-0 up helped as well,
yeah.
You know, take a bit of pressure. It's 1-0 when you get on there, you're thinking, oh, don't give away a penalty or something. But it was just excitement. I wasn't thinking of any consequence. I wasn't thinking of it in any, oh, don't make a mistake or anything else. I was just desperate to go on the pitch. And I think being young and, you know, no real fear at that point, you know, you weren't thinking too much of anything else other than, I'm about to make my Celtic debut here. Something that you'd kind of hoped would happen, but it came along a lot faster than I thought it would.
Do you think, Stevie, there's got to be a very different mentality for a goalkeeper to a player like John? So John's coming on and being part of a team that's playing. When you then, as a goalkeeper, make your first team debut, the play's coming to you.
Well, that's instruction.
And you're playing more of an individual sometimes.
Yeah, but the instruction from your coaching staff would always be, let the game come to you. Don't go looking for things to do. You're capable of handling anything that comes to you, but you're not if you start looking for scenarios and making them happen. You know, a lot of times goalkeepers will be quite happy to go through the game without contributing negatively, and you will contribute negatively if you start looking for situations to get involved in, looking for shouting for back passes when you don't. You should be coaching the ball ahead, coming for crosses when there's absolutely no chance, and finding yourself out of position. So I think you've got to try and calm people down and say, you know, let the game come to you. You're perfectly equipped to deal with whatever scenario happens, and you've just got to be confident in that.
And as a young goalkeeper, if you go into it, so was the Clydebank team experienced when you got into it?
It pretty much was, yeah, it was. I would have been the one chasing about looking for things to do, and I'd be looking for somebody to calm me down. We started off with a win. My first game was against Stirling Albion. We won 2-1 at home, and I thought to myself I'd done fantastically well, and we'd won, so that covered up any mistake that I might have made. But pretty soon I realised, no, you've got to just do your job, do it well, do it to high standard, and that's enough.
And is it difficult as a young goalkeeper to then start bossing around, but instructing defenders what you're wanting them to do?
No, if you're confident that what you're saying is right and it's helping the team, then no. That's something you've got to have, the self-confidence and knowledge that what you're saying is the right thing to do and it's helping the team. If you're just shouting for the sake of it, then experienced pros will tell you to shut up pretty quickly.
So,
and did.
For most people who listen to this, they'll know you predominantly. I mean, your time at Preston North End as well, and I didn't realise until a brief time at St Mirren, which has passed me by.
I went part time at St Mirren when I left Motherwell, and that was 2 years. I took a contract for 2 years there, and it was part time, and that enabled me to do my coaching badges and actually to do some coaching on the side. So it suited both parties for me to be part time at that point.
But you spent most people will know you from Motherwell.
From Motherwell, yeah.
What was your best time as a player? What was your best game?
And best time at Motherwell was when I first went there. Alex McLeish, who was the manager, said to me, your first three games will be Havnar, Boltfalag and UEFA Cup qualifiers. You'll play Rangers, the unfurling of the flag at Ibrox, and you'll play Clydebank, your old team, in the League Cup. And I thought, you've sold me. European Cup, Ibrox and my old team. So, you know, three fantastic games to be involved in. And that season we finished second in the league. We were neck and neck with Rangers right up to New Year's Day. And then they pulled away and I think won by about 11 points by the end of the season. But we finished second and felt that we were just about to, on the cusp of, you know, doing really well. And then Alec went to Hibs.
Yeah.
And we changed the tactics managerially. We went with Harry Campman and that, you know, set us back a little bit at that point. But no, that was my best year. Playing with some top players, Tommy Coyne, Owen Coyle, Billy Davis, you know, it was a solid team. Brad McKinnon at left back, you know, not standout players, but in that team they all knew their jobs. They could give anybody a game on their day. So that was a fantastic time to be at Motherwell.
What was your best performance that you felt?
We played, probably that year, we qualified for the UEFA Cup and we got Borussia Dortmund home and away, and I played well in both those games. So for me, you know, that was a tough test. And I thought that we acquitted ourselves really, really well. I think we get three guys sent off over the two games, which put us behind it and made me busier the whole game. But no, I made a number of saves and did really well.
I mean, I know we just talked about the game coming to you, but did you prefer to be busy?
Yes, always. I would always prefer to be busy. I was just saying to John, I would love to play in this type of football that Celtic are playing just now, where the goalkeeper's pivotal. Mm-hmm. You know, this modern football where the goalkeeper's the 11th man in possession. I would love to have been involved like that. That would have been right up my street.
Which then gets me on to, I'm going to come on to your career in a minute, but then gets me just what you touched on there. Why do you think more goalkeepers are not senior coaches at clubs? Because the game it gets played, you're the only player that the whole game gets played in front of.
I think they can do it.
They're all mental.
They're all mental, yeah, that's a good point. No, I think that the best suited players are midfielders. I think they understand the game. They can repair the game in game. Mm-hmm. They can sort things out. They see tactically what's going on. I think the goalkeepers are fantastically positioned to help the back four. Beyond that, I think we're a little bit naive if we think we can start to coach midfielders and strikers. That's just my opinion.
On your career, John, which although it was more brief than anybody wanted, It was eventful.
It was, huh?
I'd actually forgotten, because in the memories of Celtic fans, your career just finished too early. But I'd forgotten you had a period out on loan at Norwich as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, when I was reading into that, it was talking about how well you played at Norwich.
And it was. We were actually met by an old friend this afternoon, and we were talking about my time as well. So basically, I'd came kind of broken the same with Kenny. Had, I think, maybe five appearances that year towards the end of that season, which was a struggle. Obviously, it was a change in management, things weren't going well, but there was an opening there for me and a few other young players to kind of put your name out there as, you know, having a possibility in the future to become a player. So I enjoyed that experience. Then Martin Neal came in, going pre-season with him, then went back to reserves, which, looking back, and it was a good decision, you know, because, you know, I wasn't ready to play week in, week out with Celtic at that point. So moved back to the reserve in youth football and was there. But occasionally Martin would pull you up and put you in a game randomly or be around the first team and everything else. And then just the season progressed, probably 2003-04 was a real season where I played, you know, at that point broke into the team and was with the first team consistently. You know, I started to play a number of games continuously and consistently. Came back out of the team a bit, and then round about the Barcelona time kind of broke back on in the team again. So that was this kind of break-in season. Although I'd made a couple of appearances here and there before that, was the kind of main season before my injury, and it was probably the most important one, you know, because I think that was the one that I think coming in for a game, you know, two games, three games is good, you know, but I think it's Celtic, it's going over a period of time, and, you know, I felt the more I played, the more comfortable I was feeling in the team and doing reasonably well. I remember having an absolute stinker away to Hibs in the League Cup, I'm sure it was, gave away a penalty and was dropped, rightly so, after it. And I think for the next 4-6 weeks, wasn't really involved. Spoke to Martin about it, who pulled me actually and says, look, just giving you a bit of time out, come out of it, you know, you've played a number of games in a row now, you know, you've been around it, you're a young player, come back out, you'll come back stronger. And he gave me the confidence that, you know, our opening's going to come again. It wasn't a case of you're dropped and then no one said anything. So I knew, you know, we had my best interests at heart. And then after the new year, then leading into Barca, I played a few games. Played in the Barcelona game, which is, again, probably one of the biggest experiences of my career. Then we went to Ibrox on the Sunday after that, 1-2-1 there. I think it was Alan Thompson and Henrik that scored, I think. And then got injured in the midweek, making a Scotland debut, so things came crashing down. And then from then, you know, through that period, so between, it was pretty much 3 years, pretty much, before I actually made an appearance with the first team again. You know, after 2 years, pretty much been fit, but had to kind of find my fitness, find my sharpness again. You know, and that took about 6-7 months to do that. But in that period when I was out, you know, going back to my debut, it was that feeling that always gave me the drive to work every day. You know, there was periods in there it was tough and you weren't quite sure how it was going to pan out, but I thought, you know, I'm going to give myself the best opportunity just to get that feeling again. And then coming back, my first game back was when we won the league at Kilmarnock, and I came out a free kick in the last minute. And I remember that before that game, again, it was like being a kid again, you know. Had some experience in terms of some games, had my period out injured, you know, but going into that game, in terms of mentally, I was more mature, you know, and I knew what to expect, I knew roughly how the game would pan out and what I had to do. But the excitement and the buzz I had was like it was 16 again. And I think that's more from growing up and around it and being a fan and going into the game knowing if you win it, you're going to win the league and everything else, so. You know, that in itself. So anyway, that season finished, went into the next season, got injured again. And then after that, ended up finishing my career at Norwich. But went down to Norwich and it was good for me because I think at the time at Celtic, I'd numerous setbacks, you know, came in, was back out injured, back in, back out injured. You know, and you start to kind of, people then start to question, you know, is he going to last? Is he going to be finished? You know, he's not looking quite the same. And so, you know, spoke to Gordon about it and the decision was made to just get out of Scotland really and just go and play somewhere where it's fresh, new environment, fresh environment, just get games under your belt. And I had a great time down there, but I remember towards the end of it, I think, you know, the initial buzz going and getting playing again, but I remember it was a period down there the last month or 2 months where, you know, I could feel I was struggling a little bit, you know, physically. My knee wasn't the way I wanted it to be, and you know, it was giving me more problems than it probably should have. So I had an idea at that point, you know, I've not got long left here. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting with my wife after one of the games, coming in, usual ice packed up, and taking anti-inflammatory medication, and she's saying, look, you need to get this into you again, there's something not right with you. And I remember at that point saying, you know, this is my last chance, you know, because I spoke to the surgeons and been through the process of surgery and everything else, but I knew I was kind of, this was my final one, you know, if it goes again, then I'm probably done here. So I says, no, I'm not, I'm just going to keep playing. If something happens, you know, that's what happens, but I can get through the games, not ideal, I'm struggling a little bit, but I just want to keep going. And I remember speaking to Gordon actually, so I'd done actually reasonably well, although physically I didn't feel great, and I felt like I was slightly hindered, you know, my performances, but on the whole I actually did okay down there. Spoke to Gordon, he was like, right, we're bringing you back in January, so when January comes around again you're coming back to Celtic. And in a way I was like, okay, that's great news, I want to go back to Celtic, but I'm not in the best of places here. But I never told him that. But then 2 games before I was actually due to go back, my knee actually gave way again. So, you know, things happened, got my surgery, seen the surgeon, and he says, look, it's time to call a day. You've been through a lot, you've done fantastic to get back playing. From when I first seen you to what you've been through and how many games you've actually managed to play, you know, I was surprised. So, you know, thank your lucky stars you got back to get that feeling again, but you know, now it's time to call it a day and go down a different path. And in a sense, it was relief for me, because mm-hmm. I was going through, you know, I was battling, you know, on a daily basis to get through training, to prepare myself for the games and everything else, and it kind of just consumed my life. You know, I wasn't coming away from training and enjoying, you know, life with my young kid and my wife and everything else. I was coming back from training pretty much laying on the couch trying to get myself right for the next day. You know, so kept that hidden behind closed doors, and then we'd go out and try and play. You know, so in a way it was a blessing that the surgeon made the decision for me to, you know, it's time to stop before you do yourself some long term damage.
But do you think those additional games you got after the first big injury helped in terms of, you've just talked there about, you knew you didn't have long,
yeah,
and you were trying to maximise, whereas if you'd just not been able to play again after that injury, it would have been a more...
Yeah, I think it would have been more blunt, and it would have been harder to deal with. I think, you know, I had numerous setbacks in my time, but I think as each one happened, you know, it made me a bit stronger mentally. You know, I kind of could then read ahead what might be coming, whereas if you get, you know, all of a sudden one day you're, you know, playing against Rangers at Ibrox, you go into an international debut and then it comes to a stop there without no warning, then, you know, it'd be quite hard to take. But I think in over the course of time, you know, I realised what was happening. I started to kind of forge out my mind, you know, right, okay, I'm not going to play till I'm 35 here. You know, it's going to be a much shorter career. What am I going to do? And the coaching thing was always my mind. You know, it's not at that point I said, I'm going to be a coach. That was never the case. But in my mind, the way when I was injured, I used to sit in the stand and I'd think of the manager's messages going into the game, and I would try and watch the game through his eyes and through his message in a way, and try and, so I'm not just there watching the game, I used to watch it in a different way from I used to. So probably looking back then, that was in the beginning of me, you know, enjoying that side of the game and thinking in a different way.
You played under a few managers, so as part of your coaching philosophy, do you take and think, I enjoyed playing football under that guy, so that's the way I think football should be played, or does that impact?
There's bits and pieces. I think, you know, I've been fortunate with, you know, Martin, Gordon, obviously working with Brendan now as well. There's bits that you take from each manager, but I think you have your own view in the game as well. You know, I think if you're strong enough as a person, you have your own view on how you think the game should be played. Going around, being around Celtic for all the time, so although I'm a defender, I've always thought of the game in a very, you know, forward thinking way and attacking manner and how we should be played, because when you grew up and you were taught as a young player at Celtic, although you were a defender, it was pretty much about mm-hmm. the attacking side of the game. You know, you defended well and everything else, but you know, it's the enjoyment factor, you know, the element of the Celtic way and how the game should be played. So been around that for long enough to have that side of me, but also done a lot of club visits and being around different places to get an insight into different managers, different clubs, how they do things. And then I think over a period of time, you just kind of bring all things together and you become a more rounded coach, but you have a better view on how you see the game and how you would like it to be played. And fortunately enough, now working with fantastic manager Brendan, who, you know, my views on the game over the number of years that I've been coaching now is, you know, fits very much in line with how he plays, and, you know, he's a fantastic manager to work with and learn from.
I'll get more onto your coaching bit in a minute, but Stevie, I pushed John as being a fantastic coach, but my first Celtic game was in 1974. I've seen lots of Celtic goalkeepers, and without decrying anybody else in the past, the best three Celtic goalkeepers in my lifetime have been three Celtic goalkeepers that you've coached. And there's a lot of Celtic fans give you the full credit for all of that. And obviously you're going to then turn around and say, well, there's a guy that's into it. But what does a goalkeeping coach add to things?
Well, the three you talked about, obviously Arthur was the first one that I got. Yep. And we got Arthur at the end of his Celtic career, and it was a case of motivating him, so I had to give him motivation. Mm-hmm. I remember speaking to him about, we're about to play Kilmarnock, and he said, Stevie, you can't motivate me for Kilmarnock. I've played them 25 times since I've been up here, and I thought, right, that's going to be a task. So I spoke to him in great detail to find out what actually made him tick. Got a sort of personal relationship with him and a trust with him, and we built up. He actually opened up and said, listen, I want to play in Serie A, and ended up playing in Serie A. So a lot of that motivation came from him. Mm-hmm. And building blocks to try and get him towards leaving Celtic to his dream place, was to play in Serie A. So that's what the goalie coach can give you. He can give you motivation for him. Fraser, we gave him a platform. He wasn't playing with Newcastle, he'd been at Stockport. Alan Thompson fantastically recommended him to the club and had seen something when he was at Newcastle, but we gave him opportunity. With that opportunity came a very raw goalkeeper who needed a lot of work, but he was so open-minded about it. He dedicated himself, a true 24-hour athlete. You know, he changed the way he ate, slept, travelled to see his mum and dad less because it was impacting on his fitness. He dedicated himself 100% to being a better goalkeeper, and got himself to a World Cup, got himself a move to the Premiership, and he got that. And then Craig Gordon came here with, you know, so much to prove. Had lost 2 years of his career, had been told a little bit similar to John's story that he might not play again, and he sort of trusted me. So he came to me and said, listen, do you think you can get me playing again? And I said, I think you can. I think it's going to be a limited involvement at first, but I think he can definitely get back to playing. And the plan was for him to come and be number two to Fraser and play maybe 8 to 15 games. Mm-hmm. And then we sold Fraser for £10 million, and all of a sudden I said, the goalposts have been moved, it's going to be 60 games this season. Mm-hmm. So we had to then adapt his training regime. But no, everybody looks for different things. You can't possibly go through the same curriculum and make an excellent goalkeeper. You've got to adapt and improvise.
He must be particularly proud because Connor Hazard's got a call up today.
Connor has, but again, he's had that opportunity because he's been allowed to go and play. Brendan decided that we wanted to let him go and loan this half of the season. Obviously, with goalkeepers, you can only have one jersey. Only one person can play. And we've spoken about opportunity recently. Connor's had the opportunity to go to Falkirk and play, excel and be picked. Fantastic. And then at the weekend, Scott Bain gets the opportunity. So he came and loaned to us, and the whole time I'm saying, I'm hoping you're going to get your chance, because this is why you're here. You can get your chance in front of the manager, but until you get the acid test of playing at Ibrox in a high-pressure game as your debut, you've not played for 6 months, but you're ready. So he got the opportunity and he took it. So it's all about getting that opportunity and being in a position physically, mentally, tactically to take it. So
how much has goalkeeping changed from when you made your debut to now? I'm just thinking of the balls being lighter and moving in the air, and
that's changed, but the whole position's changed. I mean, it used to be that you never left your 18-yard box. You know, when I started, you could get pick up passbacks. Mm-hmm. I mean, when that rule changed in 92, I think it's changed everybody's perception of goalkeepers. The shape of goalkeepers, you're talking about Lachie, big, strong, robust guy, having to deal with shoulder charges. It's evolved now into the modern goalkeepers, 6'2", 6'3", built very slightly, De Gea would be the absolute epitome of the modern goalkeeper. Very, very quick, very agile, great distribution, can fight his corner on aerial balls and things like that. But just two-footed, can play centre mid if he really wanted to. So it's changed, it's evolved massively.
I mean, for the big thing I noticed growing up, you know, you'd watch Sports Night and there'd be a Man United, somebody UEFA Cup game, and the foreign goalkeeper would punch the cross.
Yes.
And every single time, without fail, John Watson or Barry Davis would then say, look at him, he's not confident, because he hadn't caught the cross. Because in the UK, all goalkeepers went for crosses and caught them.
Yeah.
We ignored the fact that they dropped some of them, but,
yeah,
but they all went for crosses and dropped them. Whereas now, it seems to me, as a viewer from the outside, more the exception that a goalkeeper will come for a cross ball compared to 30 years ago.
30 years ago, I could tell you for sure that there wouldn't be that many set-piece specialists that can put the ball. You know, you talk about Beckham, Nakamura, you know, top level. If you had a corner in the last minute of a game, they could put it right on the money. And now you're looking at set-piece delivery being very, very flat, very, very hard, and moving all over the place. So if you've got a sloppy cross, hang up in there, any goalkeeper will come and take it. Now you have to be absolutely sure that you're coming to get it. You must make contact with the cross, or else you don't come for it. So the whole sort of philosophy's changed. You'll maybe say, we want the goalkeepers to have as much seeing time as possible. We play with a high line for that very reason, so that the ball's got to be very, very precise. We don't sit back on the goalkeeper, eating into his sort of positional distances, and it means that his decision making's much more clear.
See on that, just when you said about vision, it's one of the things that's always got me about free kicks. So in a game, in game time, you'll hear commentators and talking about, I don't mind if a guy shoots from 30 yards, because the keeper's got loads of time to see it. Yet as soon as it becomes a set piece, we give the goalkeeper half the distance to be able to see. Have you ever thought about, I'm not suggesting this, it's just, have you ever thought about doing away with a wall?
Such a good point. Do you know what I would do if I was the opposition? I'd put a wall in place, because the best thing you can possibly do is move the goalkeeper. So if you don't put up a wall defensively to help you, I would put one up offensively to offside the goalkeeper, or unsight the goalkeeper, sorry. So it would work both ways. If Celtic decided not to put a wall up, I'm sure the opposition would put one up, because it acts so...
Do you know, I think maybe the first two or three times they would stand there and not have a clue what to do.
No,
maybe
I think it would throw people initially, but it's such an advantage having a wall for the opposition that... If the team in question didn't do it, we've spoken about this loads of times, we're saying, would he get beaten by a shot from 30 yards? How many shots from 30 yards would Lee Griffiths score if there wasn't a wall? Well, very quickly you'd see somebody would put a wall up, because it would help them.
Which then gets me on to defending as a whole. So both you guys here, and I know, John, you're not, this is the misconception, is it not, that you're the defensive coach? There's no such thing as a defensive coach, is that right?
I've heard this a few times though, from various people. It's been mentioned you're a defensive coach, but there's been no such thing ever. Even here, or at all the clubs I've visited or been around, there isn't anybody that's consigned to be the defensive coach. So I've heard that a few times, but I can declare it's
usually false. When we've lost and somebody's looking for someone to blame.
That's culture in Scotland, isn't it? But it's pretty much, it's never been the case. You know, I work as much with the whole team, or the defenders, or the strikers, or the wingers, or the midfielders, same as the manager would. Chris would you do a bit with them? So it's very much across the board, because the way we work, it's also units at different times, you know, but it all comes back in as a team thing, you know. So in terms of, and that's the one where, you know, when you can see the goal, the first line is what's the defenders doing, you know. But whereas from a coaching element, we'll look at the bigger picture. Yeah, it might have been an individual error, then okay, fine, you know. But, you know, if it's been a shot from an area or a cross that's came in, we'll strip it back and work around the team model in terms of, right, okay, as a team, you know, what could we have done better? The same as when we score, or we're not creating enough chances, whatever it might be. It's not just, right, what's the strikers doing? It's stripping that back to a point, right, okay, what's the team doing? Because it's the team that will create chances and score goals. It's the team that will, you know, stop chances and stop goals. So I don't know where it's came from, actually. I don't know who's...
I think it's because people like to pigeonhole.
Yeah.
And so you used to be a defender. You're now a coach. They understand the manager's job,
yeah,
but they don't really... I mean, I couldn't walk into a training ground and then say, right, okay, I know why I need four different coaches. Obviously, being a specialist, Stevie, a goalkeeping coach, but I couldn't, as a layman, I couldn't walk in and then say, I know how we set up the whole coaching staff here. So it's then a perception that you must have a guy who coaches the defenders, a guy who coaches the forwards.
No.
Nobody seems to be a coach of the midfielders for some reason, but I think that's the where
it
comes
from. I think what it is because it's at the top end and it's like two boxes, you know. So at the top end, they'll be scoring goals. If we're not, then okay, what's the strikers doing? You know, at the other end, if you're conceding goals, what's the defenders doing? Yeah, so, and I think this again goes back to like whose fault is this, you know. But you know, across the board, the whole coaching staff, you know, are equally led by the manager, you know, equally part of coaching the team. But that's the way.
So to ask them a couple of technical questions, since I've got a goalkeeper and a defender, although you're not a defensive coach. Guys on the post, guys not on the post. Why? Since the traditional thing, getting back to the when the keeper came out, the traditional thing in British football was two guys on either post and then man marking. Why do you not have guys in the post, or why would you only have one post?
There's different reasons for it. It goes back to how you set up. So again, it depends on personnel. So you find like, you go to Man City now, Guardiola has always been like pretty much full zonal, you know, in terms of how he defends set plays. He'll go zonal, so he'll basically identify the areas in the box which are most dangerous, where most goals are likely to come from, and he'll put players in the areas and deal with that because of blocks which can easily be done and everything else. You know, we have pretty much a slight mix where we have a guy front area, we have man markers, we sometimes leave two up the pitch, three up the pitch, whatever it might be, depending on personnel we have or the opposition we're playing. But the back post one became important at times because a lot of headers, you know, especially flat balls coming in, and when players are running across, especially from an outswinger, most headers will veer towards the back post area. So having someone in that area can help you for a second ball.
Well, you mentioned that. Could I just see in the last 5 minutes of a must-win game for Celtic, can we always have a guy, always my whole 40 years of going to Celtic games, have a guy 10 yards beyond the back post for an attacking one? Because what has happened all my life is the guy taking the corners, pumped up with adrenaline, and overhits the corner kick every single time. Anyway, that's my wee bugbear. Always stick a guy 10 yards beyond for the overhit corner.
So you have that reason where a lot of headers will end up going in that direction towards the back post. And also, if you do it properly, you can have your front space zonal guy. If the ball goes big enough and it's a bigger cross, he can make his way onto the front post anyway. You know, he's got time to adjust that. So that's the way we set up. Every coach, again, it's your own thoughts and beliefs and things. Mm-hmm. Your own belief is to 10 minutes to go stick someone in that back area, which, you know, in your mind, that's a good idea, which is brilliant.
It's probably confirmation bias when I'm looking for it, but there you go.
Yeah, but even at that, that's your view, you know, and that's why football's kind of special in a way, because every coach, every manager, you know, has different views and different things, and that's what makes the game, you know, special in a way, because it's not just two teams who know exactly what's going to happen come together. You know, it's pretty much, you know, you can tweak things and make a difference by doing that. But the post thing, again, it's opinion. We would tend to, most of the time, have someone in the back post for that reason. Sometimes if we'll get a slightly bigger team, we might take him off and put him in a zonal position because the team's more of a threat in a certain area, or we might stick an extra player up the pitch, take him off the post. But again, we mix it up. Again, it's not something that it's game by game. So we don't say this is the way we defend set plays, and no matter who we play against, this is the way it's done. You've got to be more analytical than that and realise what you're coming up against, because if a team know exactly what you do, they're going to set up to try and counter that. So we try and read the script ahead and analyse the opposition, right, what's their trends, where are they most likely to deliver, what type of short corners have they got, and then we'll have our basis pretty much stays the same. But if you analyse through most of their corners, there'll be slight tweaks here and there as we go along. But again, that's the manager's call along with ours.
And Stevie, for goalkeepers, it just looks like more and more goalkeepers just stay inside their 6-yard box, in fact inside 1 or 2 yards on the line. Is that
going back to the quality of delivery? It's very, very difficult to come for a ball that's whipped in into a specific area where there's people attacking it, you're better off just staying and trying to defend the header or coaching your team to go and try and win the header. Again, I think you'll find most goalies, if it's a lazy ball and it's hung up, they'll come and take it. They're all capable of doing that. So it's down to the quality of delivery. You'll find that there's very few goalkeepers now that are not equipped to come for crosses, but the delivery dictates which ones they can come for and which ones they select to stay on their line for.
Talking of goalkeepers and corners, something that seems to... There was a wee fad for about 5-6 years that seems to have disappeared again, is goalkeepers coming up for corners in the last minute. That seems to have gone.
It's the walk of shame when you've got to go back, though. It's embarrassing. I just think that... I only ever did it once in my career, did it at St Mirren in some cup game, and I hated it. I hated it because the likelihood of you getting on the ball is very, very slim. I know it seems to have died away. I think Liverpool had the chance last week and Karius was looking to Klopp to try and he said no. So it's just a case of, you know, personally I didn't like to go up. I think it's a wee bit desperate. I think if your men can deal with that better than goalies can, and there's a good reason for that.
I always think that the bit going back is like if you're late for a train and you're in the wrong platform, you have to run up and, you know, it's like the platform's running in slow motion going the other way.
It's a walk of shame. It's embarrassing for you when you have to go back after they've avoided you and the cross from the corner.
And on to also talking about goalkeeping coaching. So you are now Scotland's preeminent goalkeeper coach because you are now the Scotland goalkeeper coach as well.
I'm really looking forward to it. Meet up on Sunday after our game against Motherwell, and I can't wait to get started. As a coach, you want to coach at the highest level. I'm obviously working at Celtic, but the next platform that I can possibly coach at is for Scotland, and if I can help them in any way, I'm delighted to do so.
I mean, you've not done it yet, but how is that? Because you're going to take a goalkeeper who's got a club goalkeeping coach,
yeah,
and then you're going to then be speaking to him. So do you feel like you're borrowing him, or how? I mean, I know you've not done it, but how do you think it'll...
I don't think you can do much. I'm going to be away for 10 days. I've got Alan McGregor this trip and Jordan Archer and John McLaughlin. I'm not going to be able to change much. So it's going to be a case of making things as familiar for these guys as possible and taking the information that we've just spoken about how they like to set up at corners, how they like if somebody stands against them, how they like to set up their defensive walls, what their kicking plan will be. These things have got to be as familiar for these guys as possible, and that's what I'm going to be tasked with. I'm going to have to relay that to Alex and Peter Grant and James McFadden and say, right, if this goalie's going to play, this is what his strengths are, this is what his weaknesses are, this is what he likes to do, and we'll probably sit down as a coaching staff and be able to make that. You want to make it as comfortable for them as possible in every single position. My job's to make sure that the goalkeeper's as happy in that position and as well informed as he possibly can be.
So here's one that, just as you're speaking there, I was thinking about. I don't think any of Hibs, Aberdeen or Rangers have got a Scotland goalkeeper, so it's not a question that's then going to land you in it. How would you feel then taking the goalkeeper off if we were in a tight title challenge on Scotland training?
No, it wouldn't bother me at all.
No?
It's just that, no, it really wouldn't bother me. Because...
Would it give you an insight into that keeper, though?
It would definitely. It would definitely. You'd see a lot more in
how do you think, more so, how do you think his club would feel about it?
Don't know about that. I can't answer that for him. I can't answer that for him. But no, you would definitely see a lot more about a goalkeeper in a training session than you ever would in a game. You would get a real close-up to see what their strengths and weaknesses were, and you'd get a real good feel for their character within an hour of working with them. So it'd be a difficult one for... Thankfully, we don't need to worry about that with Aberdeen Rangers and all that. But I wonder what Hearts will think about it, because I've got John McLaughlin coming into this camp. Hopefully, they'll enjoy the experience and come away from it refreshed and motivated. So I don't think they'll have any complaints about it.
But we'll see. It is. So obviously, Alan McLeish, I take it it's from your time together at Motherwell.
That's when I first met him. Played against Alex for Aberdeen when I was at Clyde Bank. And he remembered that game. He told me he remembered that game. And signed me for Motherwell just after that. So I've known him since I started at Motherwell, which was nearly 20 odd years ago. So obviously he then went to Hibs and went to Rangers, went to Scotland, went down south, come back to Scotland. So he's one of those people that if you're ever at a dinner, you go and say hello to him, touch base with him, and you always keep in touch with your managers. So.
And John, where do you, without saying, oh, I'm going to leave or whatever, but where do you see your career going, because you're one of the main coaches now at Celtic, so...
Yeah, I think for me, I've always stated at some point in my career I'd like to be a manager, whenever that may be. But you know, I've never been in a rush for it because you know my pathway. Even when I finished playing, and I thought, right, I'm going to make sure I go through the process, do things right, and make sure I've got as much behind me as I possibly can before I make that step. Obviously, having worked with the youths, worked with the reserves, been in scouting and recruitment, and doing opposition analysis and all that kind of things, it's given me an insight into different things. And working with the young players, you know, I've been able to try things, work on things. Whereas when you come to first team, everything's performance. You know, you're very much developing the players, you know, on a daily basis. You know, but at the end of the week, there's a performance you need to put in, so you're preparing them for that as well. So that goes hand in hand. Whereas, you know, youth football and reserve football is solely development. You know, and of course, being at Celtic, you want to go and win things as young players, but you know, it's all about getting to the first team. So, you know, I've had a great grounding. I've been working with some fantastic people at a fantastic club, and you know, for me, it's at this moment, I think it's savouring the moment I'm in. I think when the manager came in and I spoke with him, I sat down in his hotel and had a chat with him, and he says, listen, I want you to stay here and be in my coaching staff and work closely with us. And you know, it's been a real insight. You know, and again, I think over a period of time as a coach, you have ideas and you see the game in certain ways, and sometimes different from others, sometimes from others. But there's so many things that, you know, the managers brought in at the club that I thought, yeah, that's what I was thinking along the lines of. And it gives you the confidence that a top manager, you know, thinks in a similar way to yourself. And is there some new ideas which I thought, great, that's a great idea and something different for me going forward. But, you know, I think at the moment full focus is on what we do here, you know, being as successful as we possibly can. And I think in football you never quite know what's around the corner. That's the thing. It's one of these jobs where, you know, things can move on ever so quickly, you know, good and bad. So I just got to savour the moment. You know, as I said, at some point I will jump into a management job, whenever that may be. But I'm certainly thoroughly enjoying my time working with Brendan.
So obviously won a treble last season, and we've got a good chance of winning the treble this season. So the big thing for the supporters is where we are outside in European football. How do we bridge that gap? Because we can't buy that golfing gap. So how do we do it through? Are we capable of doing it through coaching?
Yeah.
How do we do it?
There's an extent to that in terms of, you know, the managers came in with, you know, new ideas, fresh ideas, which the players have obviously picked up on and done very, very well with, you know. But European football, I think, you know, the stronger teams are getting stronger and stronger, and pulling away from everybody because of the financial implications and what's involved at that level. But, you know, even the other teams are, you know, getting stronger. So we need to obviously stay with that. But I think part of it's coaching, you know, in terms of getting the most you possibly can out of your team.
You know, sorry to interrupt, on that, do you think what you went through personally in terms of being out for 2 years, coming back in and then being told your career was finished, do you think that gives you a strength of mind?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's something that, you know, I'm not overly emotional. I don't, when things are, you know, not going exactly as planned, you know, I always revert back to, you know, right, okay. Because the biggest worry is when you don't do well in Europe, you know, fantastic domestic season, which can be great. You maybe don't do well in Europe and you want to change everything. That's what you don't do. What you need to do is try and make what you're doing better and improve it in other aspects. So, you know, very much for the manager, he's brought in his own style of play. You know, the players have taken to that, you know, and doing well in that respect. And again, going forward, they're only going to get better and better with, you know, the type of coach he is and the environment they're working in. But on top of that, you obviously need to recruit good players. So again, it's constantly, and it's not been a case of, you know, wholesale changes with the manager. You know, he's getting, you know, in the main, the most out of the players, what he's got here. And then he's bringing in the players of quality when it's possible. So I think that's one for us as we move forward, is, you know, keeping as much of the group together as we can and improving them. But as we move along, trying to bring in more and more quality, which then hopefully, you know, kicks the team on another level and allows you to be more competitive at European level.
Because obviously there's been a lot of debate about the size of the defeats in Europe, and I can see both sides of the argument for you're not gonna improve if you decide to change the way you play just to avoid getting a doing.
No, I'm not saying you totally change the way you play, because what we have is we have certain principles which we stick to, you know, but tactically, you know, at no point has the manager ever said there's anything wrong with, you know, sitting that bit deeper and being harder to beat. You know, he wants to play with a team who tries to dominate the ball, but he also knows when you play PSG that's very, very difficult. So he knows going into the game, and it makes the team feel aware, you know, you might not be dominating possession here, but what I do want is when we do get the ball, I want it to try and be, you know, be better than we have been. You know, so, and I think it's a confidence factor as well, you know, going into European football. You know, we missed out for a couple of years in the Champions League stuff. We came back in last year, had a great experience in terms of getting back and having that feeling around the place. This year we'd obviously like to have done better, but you know, we are where we are, and I think going forward it's the experience of the players who have went through that again, because as much as, you know, and did well in certain games, the players, when they've not done well, they know it, you know, and they feel the opportunity's passed us by, and so you want that to come around again and say, right, okay, there's your next opportunity, go and do it.
The thing that struck me, and I'm not going to ask you to comment in the game, so don't worry, the thing that struck me during the Zenit game was Chris Sutton making the reasonable observation in commentary on television that we played so well at Celtic Park against Zenit and not as well away in Zenit. And what was really striking me was Chris Sutton kept saying, why is that? How can a team change in 7 days? And what was frustrating me as someone watching it is because, well, I'd seen a team that Chris Sutton had played in do exactly the same thing. I remember watching Celtic play away to Porto and getting beaten 3-0, going on 75-0. A team that had beaten Porto at Celtic Park. You didn't play as many of those games, but you were in and around a squad that did the same thing, beat teams at Celtic Park who they had no right to beat on paper, and then got a doing away from home. Is it in there? Is it in the head?
No, I think there's an emotional factor in the game, you know, because you think everybody talks about, you know, the atmosphere at Celtic Park. And without a doubt, you know, it gives the players extra energy, that bit more confidence, because they feel that they're backed, you know. And you sometimes see it the other way at Celtic Park, when maybe the crowd get a bit edgy, the players get a bit edgy. You know, and to an extent it can be mental, but there's an emotional factor, and that's why the manager will always say, look, get behind the team, push us forward, because you make us better. And that's fully true. When you go away, you've got the flip side, where they now they've the home backing, you know, and they've got that little bit more support from the group, the noise, you know, it's in their favour, you know. But as players, you go there, and when you're in game, you maybe don't recognise it as much, you know, as people might think. But I think if we knew the answer, we'd be doing much better. That's that's the thing. It's so difficult to pinpoint this as the reason why. I think there's a number of factors to it. I think there's, you know, the mentality of the opposition. I think the Zenit one as well is, in a knockout game, when there's two legs, going into that second leg, they know, as do we, but on their home patch, they know exactly what they've got to do. We're obviously in control of the game, as is before it kicks off. You know, we're in a good position. You know, so they're basically saying, right, we need to go for this here. We've nothing else to lose. We know what we need to do. You know, whereas we're in a position where, okay, we need to see the game out, get through the tie. We're ahead, and then it's the mindset of it. You know, and what the manager's very good is framing things that might happen in the game. You know, in terms of preparing the players, okay, this might happen in the game, that might happen in the game, blah, 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 and this is what we do. And, you know, he's good as I came across in terms of that respect, psychologically with the players. So, and they're a fantastic group, you know, but, you know, there's no rhyme or reason why on any given game, you know, you don't perform to the level you hopefully do. And it's as frustrating for, you know, the manager and the coaching staff and the players as for the fans, you know. And the fans get obviously emotional, and rightly so, and they travel a long distance to support the group. I mean, they don't get a performance, you know. They feel hard done to, and they expect better. But, you know, in-house we're exactly the same. You know, we expect better, and we hopefully can, as time goes by, hopefully turn that round and be, you know, in a much stronger position in European football.
So we've got a good young goalkeeper in Conor Hazard playing at Falkirk. What's his attributes?
He's 6 foot six. He loves coming for crosses. He's very confident in himself. He's got a wonderful left foot. But I think his biggest strength is his self-belief. He's come here and he's massively driven. He's desperate to be Celtic's number one goalkeeper. He knows that he's not going to become that by staying here and being number two or number three. He's gone out to Falkirk to try and play. And a big part of his future will be dictated by the next sort of six, seven, eight games that he plays for Falkirk to see how well he does. I think he's going to be with the Northern Ireland squad this week. Hopefully, I think they've got one game. He's quite confident he's going to play, but he's quite confident he's going to play for everybody. So I don't know. I'm not going to take too much of what he says at face value. It's up to Michael O'Neill. But I think if he played for them, that would be a big stepping stone for him to show what he's capable of.
I mean, it's like, you obviously don't need to comment. And I noticed that he's been playing for Falkirk, didn't play against the Rangers, and seems to be back in the Falkirk game sort of that.
I can't comment because I don't really know. Yeah. It doesn't make much sense to me because he had played 5, won 4, drawn 1, 3 clean sheets and then never played against Rangers. So I don't know. You'd need to ask Paul Hartley that. But he brought him back in last week and they won. So hopefully he'll cement his place now for the rest of the season.
So you got hopes he could... Obviously he knows he can make it. Because
he's told me that.
Yeah. Right. Can he?
Oh, he's got every chance. He's got every chance. But the opportunity's got to be there for him. If Craig Gordon, Doris De Vries or Scott Bain is playing really, really well, there won't be an opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, but you never know if there's going to be an injury or a sending off or just some freak occurrence like there was last week. He'll be ready for it. And it's up to him then to see if he's ready physically, technically, tactically to take that opportunity. And I'm sure he will be.
So if you were then, if there's anybody listening to this who's a young goalkeeper coming through, apart from obviously trying to make sure that you eat the right diet so you can grow, because it strikes me that Scott Bain's quite small for a modern top level goalkeeper.
Yeah.
That it does seem to be 6 foot, or you know, if you look at the English Premiership, it's 6'4" plus seems to be the height for every goalkeeper. But apart from that side of it, what would your main thing be that you would say to young goalkeepers?
Make sure you play at any level, even if you're playing at a level that's well below your capabilities. Go and play every single week. Don't be sitting on the bench. Don't be sitting getting 5 minutes, 10 minutes game time. Go and play, and it'll pretty much become apparent that you're far too good for that level, or that is your level. But you've got to go and play. What you can't do is just sit there twiddling your thumbs, thinking, "Oh, I wish." You know, you're not going to prove anything to anybody just by training. So it's when you get that chance to play a game, that's when you find out how you can maximise your potential.
Pay Stevie Woods for some one-on-one goalkeeper.
I'm very cheap.
Can I do for the Woods? You think it's not by chance, you know, with Stevie, that, you know, Fraser and Craig, and the young goalkeepers, have came to the position they're in? Because I share an office with him now, and they're never out of there, constantly in. And it's not a case of coming in for a chat. He's very, very thorough in terms of how he plans out their week, plans out their quarterly season, everything else going beyond that. He's very, very thorough in terms of ticking all the boxes. You know, you talk about, you know, a car comes through a factory and they go through the process and they tick the box, move on, tick the box, move on. You know, Stevie very much works to that, and I see it firsthand. So it's not by chance that these guys have just fell on his lap. He's actually produced them and helped him along the way. So.
Which is one of the things you talked about, Fraser Foster being raw. That was the big thing. I think every Celtic fan would notice. You had him out. Did he ever go to a half-time team talk?
What we found with Fraser was, obviously, Lenny was the manager, and Lenny would have his say to Fraser, and then he would go into the rest of the team. And what you find is that it's a great opportunity to actually go and speak to the goalie about anything that's gone right or anything that's gone wrong in the first half, and get them a chance to have a look at the conditions for that goal mouth in the second half. And Fraser really, really liked that. Craig doesn't. Craig likes me to speak to him in the dressing room and go over things verbally. He doesn't need that feeling of familiarity to go and do some volleys or some crosses or anything like that. It was just Fraser. That was a thing that he'd grown up with at Newcastle. He wanted to get out of the dressing room, clear his head. If he'd made a mistake, clear his head. If he'd played well, clear his head. Set the reset button, speak to me about a couple of things, and then just get a wee feel for that goal mouth for the second half. A lot of the times it was done at home, and he maybe hadn't had too much to do in the first half, so it's a case of just refocusing him. But he was insistent on that, and none of the rest of the goalies have been that insistent. I'd be quite happy to do it with anybody, but I wouldn't force him.
I was going to say, is that something that you would recommend?
I've mentioned it to Craig, and he would just say, no, I don't want to do that because I've never done that. And I said to Benny last week, do I go and stand up the Copeland Road end and get things shouted at you? And he said, no, I'll deal with that when it comes. So, I'm very much... as far as the match day experience is concerned, it's their warm up, it's their game. I'm just there to help them with it. I won't insist on anything. So it's very much every decision they make's on the back of what they want.
Yeah, but I think before that, the work's done with you. Like, he's obviously saying game day is a big game, what they're comfortable with. But in the lead into that, in terms of who they're going to come up against, the type of, you know, goals they score from set plays, who's going to hit the free kicks, where it's likely to go, the training week, you know, that every box is ticked from me watching. Sometimes annoying every time they come in the office, but the goalkeepers are in regularly, and it's like not just for a pop in and a coffee, it's you know, to be prepared for the next game or go over what's just happened, reflect on that, okay, full circle, let's go again, you know. So
but I could spin that back at John and say that that's exactly the way the coaching staff deal with every single position, every single player at this club. We mention every single player in meetings every day by name, you know, asking how they're doing, how they are physically, and then what do they need today, who's going to be playing in the games, and if they're not playing, what do they need to keep themselves up in their fitness levels, again, technically, tactically, what can John and Chris Davies give them as far as video analysis of opposition. Everything is done here, and I've only been able to do that John was saying about ticking every box, because I'm following their lead. I've got to keep up to their standards, and Brendan drives that. Brendan wouldn't let either of us away with, you know, doing this job half-heartedly. Got to do it wholeheartedly, and do it thoroughly, and do it to the Celtic standards.
So we've got a game on Sunday. Mm-hmm. If you just want to tell me the team, and then
it's Motherwell. We're playing Motherwell.
So you'll be going back to how does it feel going back to Motherwell?
I've got absolutely no emotion about it at all. I just love going anywhere with Celtic. I've been a Celtic coach for nearly 10 years now. I'm very much a massive Celtic fan all my life. It doesn't make any difference to me going to Motherwell or Aberdeen or Rangers or anything. It's a real pride for me to be the Celtic goalie coach, to work with Brendan, work with John and Chris and Colo every single day. It's a real pleasure. So going to Motherwell doesn't have any fears for me.
I meant to ask this question when you mentioned Scott Bain about going back out in front of Copeland's. How's his arm? Because I noticed after the
a nasty water balloon injury. it was a real nasty, one of the severest water balloon injuries I've seen at the Copeland Road. It was real experience from Scott, because we needed to kill the game at that point, and he's just decided, right, so there was contact, and then he's felt something hitting him and he's gone down, and it killed about 2 minutes, which took the pressure right off.
I just thought it was fantastic, because I'm in the Broomloan stand and genuinely thought, oh well, 3 each with 10 men's not the end of the world. And then the woman next to me says, what's happened? And I said, I think he's missed. I think Scott Bain's got it. I think he's missed. And then the guy next to me says, must be offside, that's where it'll be. They'll have given offside, because we couldn't comprehend
how he missed it.
And then it was a good 30-40 seconds, and all of a sudden he picks up this weird injury and has to go down. But you're right, I just thought, that's fantastic. You've just
he got a nasty, I think it was a paper cup injury. Something had blown onto the pitch and hit him in the elbow, and he very cleverly went down and just killed that 2 minutes, which got us into injury thing.
No, I was going to say, we get Motherwell, are we pretty much on a countdown? Are you ticking off games to the title?
We, to be honest, it's one thing the manager doesn't allow anybody in the building to do is look, you know, to actually say, right, okay, it's this many games to win the league. It's pretty much, we take care of our business this week and we move on to next week. We take care of business. And at the end of that, then you know what's coming. You know, so he never allows you to look too far ahead. And our preparation for Motherwell, Rangers, you know, Barcelona, whoever it may be, doesn't change. And that's, you know, something the manager, he drives the standards all the time. And, you know, we're in a very good position. You know, and in the back of your mind, when you get to this stage of the season, obviously you know how far away you are. But you know, the important factor is we don't take our eye off the ball, you know, because it can quickly change in this game, and things change ever so quickly. So we just make sure we just keep standards up and approach the game in the same manner we have done, you know, and it's students in good stead, and it will do in the future as well.
Okay, with that, since that's a good hour you guys have given me, I'll say,
well,
thanks very much.
That was enjoyable for a change.
What's the goalie doing, Tom? What's the goalie doing?
Happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed.
My goodness, a curling finish. finish from Tom Rogic.
To me, this world is a wonderful place. I'm the luckiest human in the human race. I've got no silver and I've got no gold, but I've got happiness in my soul.
What's the goalie doing, Tom? What's the goalie doing?
Fading on a mountainside.
Dembele gets Celtic back on 10.
Full of stars above. When I'm in the arms of the one I love. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess.
Oh, that's a...
Failing Adam.
Hey, Tom!
Failing Adam from Semenya.
He's giving it. He's giving it a red job.
Happiness is a field of grain, turning its face to the falling rain. I see it in the sunshine, breathe it in the air. Happiness, happiness everywhere.
Dois, Dois. Rangers 2, Celtic 3.
Happiness is a frame of mind. When you go to measuring a man's success, don't count money, count happiness.
Oh,
happiness, the greatest.
And the goalkeeper gathers it on the line.
The Lord, that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. I got more than my share of happiness.
Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let
let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give.
There's plenty of other foundation events. Go to the Celtic FC Foundation's website and you'll find out about things like the forthcoming golf day again, which we'll revisit in the spring, and the Celtic Skydive. And of course, if you're just doing anything, a fun run, a 10k, a half marathon, a full marathon, you're a fitter man than me, and also you can have the Celtic FC Foundation as your chosen charity. Just get in touch. Anyway, enough of me. Hope you enjoyed the podcast. This is me, Harry Brady, saying thanks everyone for all the reviews you leave on iTunes, the comments lots of you leave on YouTube, and for downloading and listening, and speak to you again soon. That was me with Mark Cooper. Good night and God bless. Good night.
Up above, bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine.